see so many of you here today, that I think reflects the fact that this is a very interesting subject, even some 5 months after the actual event which gives rise to this subject. The subject, as you know, is after the parliamentary vote on Syria, which was at the beginning of September, the end of British military intervention ? And we have a panel of three very distinguished members of the House of Commons yesterday, who I will introduce to at the beginning, so that we can then let the proceedings run more smoothly. I may say, I think today we will get the political side of that question. The side which also interests me is, given what we are doing in our defence policy, whether there isn't another question to be asked there as to what the British could contribute to any further intervention in the future. That is for another day, although if anybody wants to comment on it a little, I'm delighted if they do. But we've got a very distinguished panel. I'm going to ask each of them to speak for about 10 minutes. And after that, I will then open it to the floor for comments and questions. Before I introduce them, I ought just to say that we have an event which will take place on Tuesday the 18th of March, which is our next lunchtime event. It will take place in this room. We'll be holding a discussion with a group of Palestinian refugees who are coming to the United Kingdom in a delegation organised by the United Nations Relief and Work Agency, West Bank Field Office. The event will be chaired by my advisory board colleague, Jack Straw, and invitations will be sent out early next week. If you are interested, you might let Jackie know on your way out. And may I say once again, many thanks to all those who have made a contribution to the running costs of GSF. If we are to continue to hold our programme of events such as this one, we really do need your help. If there's anyone who attends regularly and would like to support us, can you contact Jackie as you leave? But without more ado, I would like to turn to today's debate. I've given you the title of it. We have three speakers. On my far right, John Barron, who served as MP for Billericay District. He was elected in 2001. He's been on a number of select committees. He resigned from the front bench in 2003 to vote against the Iraq War, which I think may give us some indication of his views. He is a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and for the last decade he's been a critic of our foreign interventions. So we will have presumably a very good and clear message from him. On my next right is Jeremy Brown, who is the MP for Taunton Deane, elected in 2005. He was, as you know, following the formation of the coalition government in May 2010, a Minister of State in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. He left that office, I think, was it last year?
Year before last.
But he has a lot of experience and was involved in the Foreign Office at the time of the Libyan War. So I'm interested to hear what his views are as well. I'm delighted that he can give us the Liberal Democrat, but also his own personal view on this subject. And on my left, not just for this.
It's a rare event.
Not just a rare event. Giza and I have shared many views of the class of money will get. Giza Stewart, who's a Labour MP for Birmingham Edgbaston, elected in 1997. She was a minister in the Department of Health. She was a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee from July 2001 to 2010, so she saw a number of these interventions. She's been a member of the Defence Select Committee since June 2010, and for parliamentarians, even more importantly, she's the editor of the House magazine. So I'm going to call each of them in turn to speak on this subject, as I say, was the vote in early September the end of British military intervention. I'm going to start with John Beckham.
Thanks very much indeed, Michael, for this kind invitation to speak. Now, it is perhaps a cliché, but one that is nevertheless true, of periods of our foreign policy, that the British seldom read the writing on the wall until our backs are against it. But I do believe that we are in the middle of a reappraisal. We are now reading the writing on the wall a little bit with regards to the parameters, if you like, the bar set when it comes to military intervention. And this may be of a surprise to Michael, given his very kind introduction with regards to my opposition over the last 10 years to our military interventions, but I actually, in direct answer to the question posed, do not think that this will be the end of British military interventions. I don't think it's right that we should stop intervening. We are a global power. We have global interests. We cannot bury our head in the sand. But I do believe that what Syria illustrates is that the bar has been raised with regards to what criteria must be met before we intervene. I think Syria also perhaps highlights factors affecting the level of the bar, but it also reminds us that each intervention has its own unique set of circumstances, and Syria certainly was no exception. I mean, I should declare my hand. I oppose the Syrian intervention. I think Parliament made the right decision on the day. I think most of us would accept that Syria has been and remains a proxy war fought at different levels. You've got Sunni versus Shia, you've got the old Persian Gulf rivalry of Iran versus Saudi Arabia, you have the West versus Russia and China in some respects. And throwing cruise missiles into that mix, I think, risked making a bad situation worse and risked escalating the conflict beyond Syria's borders. The vote itself came at the end of a long summer of increasing tensions within Parliament. Initially, the government, without making any noise about it, wanted to end or not renew the embargo on arms shipments to Syria through the EU. And after a process of persistent questioning, which included foreign policy questions on the floor of the House and also a debate, which I sponsored again on the floor of the House in July, a debate that, though non-binding, also had a vote, we finally got clarification from the government that they would not intervene without first coming back to Parliament. So we left for the summer recess on that basis. But the vote itself, I think on the 29th of August, at the very end of August, how could I put it, illustrated poor party management in many respects. We were called back 4 days before Parliament was due to return anyway. And certain key questions could not be answered, such as why we could not wait for the UN inspectors to report back from their deliberations on the ground, given that the government had made such great play of getting them there in the first place. Why could we not wait to hear what they had to say? The rest is history, as they say. By a narrow margin, Parliament actually said no to supporting armed intervention in Syria. US relations, have they suffered? I would suggest not. The practicalities of foreign policy are such that you get on with the relationship if it's sound. Vietnam proved that eventually. What it did open the door to is greater Russian involvement. Russia had always been the elephant in the room, and that hopefully will prove to be a positive factor. Syria also reminded us of the extent to which perhaps the foreign policy decision-making in this country is somewhat concentrated, certainly more concentrated than it is in the States, where it is influenced by a more disparate approach, whether it's lobby groups, whether it's think tanks, whether it's interest groups, as well as the political establishment. And I think that is changing, and Syria certainly suggests that. Because following Iraq, where we went to war, quite clearly on a false premise, following the second mission, the secondary phase of Afghanistan, the first being to rid Afghanistan of al-Qaeda, but then morphed into one of nation building. I supported the first phase, I didn't support the second, because the second meant that in confusing the mission, we confused the enemy and had to take on the Taliban. I think Syria has clearly shown that the bar for military intervention indeed has been raised. Now, Libya has proved that it is a bar that is not unassailable. But Parliament, there can be no doubt, is carving out a greater role for itself, whilst allowing the Prime Minister the necessary freedoms to be able to act at short notice. And there is even talk of setting out a formal code with regards to our interventions, and indeed one of the proponents of that concept is with us in the audience today, James Gray, MP. So, if I may, Michael, may I just have a brief look at perhaps some of the factors influencing the level of this bar going forward? I certainly believe promoting liberal interventionism has been discredited. Promoting democracy through the force of arms, I think, has proved to be both costly and counterproductive. The road to democracy, jagged though it may be, I would suggest stands greater chance of success and certainly offers more hope in countries in, across North Africa and the Middle East, where we have spent relatively little in resources when compared to, say, Iraq and Afghanistan, which has cost us heavily in lives and treasure. And if to, as if to reinforce the point, it is perhaps worth reflecting back over the last 50, 60 years that where the West has intervened militarily, the old systems in those countries has tended to prevail longest. One can think of communism surviving longest in countries such as China, North Korea, Cuba, and Vietnam. Rather, instead of liberal interventionism, I think we are undergoing a process of a more hard-headed reassessment as to what can actually be achieved on the ground and what is in our best interests. And I would suggest to you that the phase one of Afghanistan, removing al-Qaeda from that country, Mali, and indeed Libya, suggests that some of the criteria one should be looking for is limited objectives, minimum risk, and therefore commitment, and most crucially, international support. And this perhaps explains why Iraq, the second phase of Afghanistan, and Syria either did not succeed or was not supported. And when it comes to international support, I don't think we should underestimate the importance of soft power or smart power, a much abused term nowadays, but it is relevant all the same. I mean, in this information age, the winning of the story will be just as important as the winning of the battle, particularly when one is trying to persuade, encourage, cajole, whatever, others to support your position. And the UK has a unique advantage in this regard, an advantage that we risk squandering if we are not too careful. Cuts, for example, to the BBC World Service, to the British Council, even to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, I think are short-sighted and can do us no good when looking forward. But I also suggest, picking up on Michael's point, that there has to be a proper resourcing of our armed forces. Because despite the best will in the world, if you haven't got the capability, then you cannot intervene. And I, for one, together with others in the House of Commons, have opposed government cuts to our armed forces, believing that they have gone far too far. And at a time when many countries in the world are actually increasing their spend on their armed forces. And if anybody thinks that the South China Seas are a long way away and nothing to do with us, then I suggest one only has to look at the extent of our trade, 90% plus of which is seaborne, actually passes through the region. So, conscious of time, Mr. Chairman, in conclusion, I would suggest that Syria does not mark the end of military intervention. It's right that it doesn't, and I speak as one who opposed Iraq, opposed the second phase of Afghanistan, and indeed opposed Libya for a different set of reasons, and Syria as well, but supported Mali, supported the first phase of Afghanistan, in believing that we have got to keep our options open because having global interests, we cannot bury our head in the sand. But I do believe that the bar has been raised, that in future it's going to be a more of a light touch template, one which has to draw on limited objectives, has to take into account minimum risks and commitment, and crucially has to have international support. And whilst accepting that every intervention will have its own unique set of circumstances, I think this development, as one who has opposed a number of our, in my view, foolhardy interventions in the past, is very much to be welcomed. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you, Michael, for your generous introduction and for inviting me at all. I was reminded during your introduction, indulge me momentarily, when you were talking about Gisela, with my favourite article I ever read about her a few days after she was first elected in 1997, which was trying to describe the scale of the political upheaval at the 1997 general election, and said that at 1 o'clock in the morning, more Germans had been elected to the British Parliament than Conservatives. Well, they did go on to say that, uncharacteristically, the Germans let an early lead slip and ended up being overtaken by the Conservatives later in the night. Now, the issue before us, I think, has been characterised by quite a lot of people as being a big turning point in the political mood and the public mood of our country, where we have gone from having a keen willingness to intervene around the world, and Tony Blair, when he was Prime Minister, was heavily associated with this role for Britain, often in conjunction with the United States, and that suddenly this turning point was arrived at, this tipping point, about 6 months ago, and we have lost our nerve as a country and have decided to head in the opposite direction. And although, of course, that is a neat way to encapsulate the choices that we face as a country, I think it is too crude a way to describe the mood in politics and the wider British public mood. I read quite a lot of newspaper commentary and heard quite a lot of observers say that this was the delayed reaction to the vote on Iraq, which took place when the other two panellists were members of Parliament, but I was not a member of Parliament. But every single Liberal Democrat MP at the time voted against the British intervention in Iraq and felt, I think it's fair to say, a degree of vindication as subsequent events unfolded, and particularly in the Labour Party, but some in the Conservatives as well, felt that they had been sold a false prospectus and thought, if we find ourselves in this position again, we will be much more cautious about believing what the Prime Minister tells us, and we will err on the side of or default towards non-intervention on the basis that when we went into Iraq we were assured there were weapons of mass destruction which could be activated within 45 minutes. We were even told about the Saddam Al-Qaeda link, and it all failed to materialise, and we won't get fooled twice. I think that was a factor. It was a factor in some of the media commentary, particularly on the left, when it came to the vote 6 months ago with regards to Syria. And I think it was quite a heavy influence on some MPs, and it certainly was a factor in the letters I got from constituents, and I'm sure other MPs got similar letters as well. But I don't think it was the only factor, and I think that is far too simplistic. And there were quite a lot of members of Parliament, including on the government side, who were quite wary about this vote 6 months ago, some of whom voted against the government, but I can tell you there were plenty of government ministers who voted with the government but were nervous about doing so, and had it been a free vote, I think would not have done so, or might at least have abstained. And their reasons for being wary were not just because they had a decade-long hang-up about Iraq. It was because they were not convinced that the merits of the case were worthy of their support. And it seemed to me that the government's case, to some extent at least, boiled down to saying, we will punish the Syrian regime for killing hundreds of their innocent civilians by killing hundreds more of their innocent civilians, just to show them that they shouldn't behave this way in the future. And I remember being in an internal discussion with my party's MPs, and it being said, if you are unlucky enough to be a security guard or a cleaner at the Syrian equivalent of Bryce Norton in about 3 nights' time, you will be wiped out by Western missiles, but quite what that will do to advance the overall objectives of the United Kingdom are unclear to quite a lot of us. And I think quite a lot of people felt in Parliament that they were being asked to take this intervention on trust, that there was no clear link between the military intervention and any wider strategic or political objectives. It was unclear to people why there was such a rush, why MPs had been called back at short notice, apart from to fit into a timetable which was convenient for the Americans, and although a lot of MPs, including me, wished to work closely with the Americans, it wasn't necessarily clear to everybody why that should be a determining factor. And maybe that, in a way, this was the most glorious or inglorious example of gesture politics. We weren't sure quite what an intervention would achieve, but we were sure that we should be seen to be doing one so that we didn't look like we were indifferent to what was happening. And I think quite a lot of, as I say, MPs in all parties, regardless of their views about Iraq, just judging this on the merits of the case, were not entirely convinced that the case was overwhelming. I was the only one on the panel at the time who was a government minister. And I voted, despite what I've just said, I voted with the government. And the reason I voted with the government is because I had a degree of ambivalence about it. I could see the case for intervening. I thought it was very important that we were unequivocal about our views on the use of chemical weapons. And I took the view as a member of the government, and maybe even as a member of parliament, that if in doubt, I should default to supporting the prime minister and the government as a whole when they recommended intervention. I think John and others may feel, if in doubt, default in the other direction. But I think that was my instinct. What was quite interesting, talking to quite a lot of MPs on the government side who did not support the government, was quite a lot, including Conservative MPs, clearly didn't feel that all other things being equal, they should give the benefit of doubt to the leader of their party and the Prime Minister. And I spoke to quite a few Conservative MPs who said, I've turned up for the statement and the debate with an entirely open mind, and I'll see whether I'm persuaded or not. And I thought, phew, this is quite a departure from the days when to rebel against your party leader and your government on a matter of war and peace was a big decision, and your default mode was to support your government and some would even say your country. And that perhaps tells a wider tale about how MPs view their role and how they now choose to hold the executive to account. Finally, what are the consequences? Well, I agree with John, which is that I think there is still a willingness to act. I think it is an exaggeration to say that this shows that we have turned our back on a global role as a country. Some of those who are most enthusiastic about liberal interventionism wrote in the newspapers at the time that this showed that Britain now had given up on having a global role, that we were terribly diminished. I felt that was an exaggeration. I think we do still have a global role as a country, or certainly we should aspire to have a global role, and I think a lot of others around the world look to us to have a global role. We are one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, and I think it's appropriate that we think in global terms. So I don't think it is the end of Britain being willing to militarily intervene. But I agree, as I say with John, that I think the bar has been raised, and the benefit of the doubt, even for quite a few politicians who are in other circumstances inclined to give that benefit of the doubt to the Prime Minister and the government, that the balance may have been tipped, and they may feel that their default option is that in the absence of a persuasive case, they are not willing to support the government. So I think there is a wariness and a weariness about British intervention. But I'll leave this final thought with you, which is that fashions can change. And there is a fetishisation, I think, a little bit in British politics at the moment, that all moral authority in the world derives from the UN Security Council, that we have, if you like, contracted out our morality to the UNSC. And that is a reaction against George Bush and Tony Blair being seen to act regardless of the views of the wider international community or a large number of them, and the United Nations. My suspicion is that the logic of that position will start to make people nervous, and it will be seen as an overreaction against Tony Blair and George Bush, and people will come to say, why aren't we doing more to help people in terrible distress? Why are we allowing China and Russia to veto our well-intentioned liberal moral interventions when we can't allow that to be a world order that is set by others and where we are willing to contract out our morality to them? And it may be that we return here for a debate in 5 years' time, and far from that being a whole new direction, the Syrian vote, it is a high water mark in terms of British non-interventionism, and the trend, the fashion, has swung perhaps not all the way back as far as it was for the Iraq vote 10 years ago, but halfway back to some midpoint between the two.
Thank you very much, Michael, and I hope my voice will hold. I'm going to try and focus as to what I think the consequences of this vote are in terms of Parliament. But just allow me a couple of observations before this. First of all, I think this is kind of Kierkegaard moment, which is, you know, life is lived forwards but understood backwards. The implications of the Syria vote will depend on what the next Prime Minister on the next occasion when he wishes to deploy troops does. And that will tell us what that Syria vote was all about. And the second one, as we're sort of in the confessional, how did I vote? I'm still a defender of liberal intervention. I probably was old enough to remember Bosnia, when without a UN mandate we went in. And everybody now accepts it was a success. And I would also assert that we have not had a comprehensive political statement as to when the UK will intervene since Chicago's Blair speech. So all this debate about what Britain can do, and I will park that because I think the chair was quite right, on the day when we announced that the Americans are reducing their army by 80,000, which, by the way, folks, is the size of our entire standing army, there may be a whole debate about what can we still do, irrespective of our intentions. So when I voted for Iraq, I thought we were wrong for the reasons why. The debate should have been why now. And I think that was the big error. And when I voted against Syria, I just want to make two observations. When sort of the Labour Party leadership rang up and said, what's your position on this? I said, we mustn't have a vote. It's simple as that. If we're going to come back on you know, ahead of Parliament, we must not divide the House on something as important as that. It was such a pathetic case that I voted against it. However, if the Prime Minister had come back on the following Monday, made a statement to the House and said, by the way, folks, we have just bombed the 22 airfields in Syria, and we've dropped the 23rd bomb in front of the Syrian president without casualty, just to say, Mr. President, by the way, this is personal. Does the House agree? I would have said, yeah, thank you very much. Which kind of takes me to what the role in Parliament is on this. But to take you through three stages. One was immediately after the debate, when the government lost. And if you're an MP and you think the government's about to lose, that's quite an occasion. But I didn't think they could possibly lose. I went back to my office. And suddenly on the screen I see the tellers coming in, and I thought, they're on the wrong side. So, you know, this wasn't just a disastrous party management, it was also quite an unexpected one. My first response was, I said, this is the Norway debate. And the reason why I said it's a Norway debate is because my predecessor, despite the fact that I'm German, was Neville Chamberlain, who of course had to abdicate as Prime Minister over the debate on the adjournment of the House over his conduct of war in Norway. And if it hadn't been for the wretched Fixed-Term Parliament Act, courtesy of the coalition, this government would have fallen as a consequence of it. It has not. So it's not the Norway debate. However, what was it? On a good day, I think it's Colombo. Those of you old enough to remember Peter Falk, you know, the bumbling detective who comes up with the right answer, but in the most mysterious, bizarre way. So we didn't intervene in Syria because I didn't think it was the right thing to do. On a more sore day, I think it was one of the most gross abdications of the powers of the executive I have seen since I've been MP, not just because of the way the House was called back early, the way the House was divided unnecessarily, either Prime Minister being defeated over something a Prime Minister should not be defeated over, i.e. going to war. And by the way, I really take issue about the voting of MPs when it comes to going to war. This is the one occasion when the party whip, whatever the whips tell you, does not apply. I've got the Centre for Defence Medicine in my patch. I see the kids when they come back and been shot to pieces. Are you really going to look at one of their parents and say, oh, I did it because the party whip said I should? No. That is the one occasion when you have to, and this is when I think a Prime Minister has to be really careful whether you divide the House. And then he compounded the error by a kind of impetuous remark at the end of the vote when he was asked whether he would now invoke the royal prerogative. And he said, no, I get it. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether what it is he got. Because, let's just think about this, what is the division between mob rule and democracy is you put in some checks and balances in the way the executive makes decisions. I would be deeply, deeply disturbed if I had a House of Commons with 654 MPs baying for going to war. I prefer a Commons that is extremely cautious and says, hold on, even if I have to say, John, you know, you're in favour of intervention, but I still haven't worked out where you would go. I mean, if Mali is the only one you would go, well, it wasn't very contentious, was it?
Afghan one.
Okay, good. Thank you. But I think we as MPs have to go back, and we've got three extraordinary tasks, I think. One is, I think whichever party it is, we need a post-Chicago speech political framework within which we think we wish to intervene and what that framework is. And Jeremy was absolutely right. This praying the UN in aid is an absolute fetish. It's sort of the second rate, you know, abdication of responsibility. The second thing which I think we really have to be clear is the way, given that we've now got to the position, irrespective of what the legislative framework says, that I don't think we can have a prime minister who will go to war without taking a parliamentary approval. And actually, I think this prime minister has cornered himself almost to saying he's going to have a vote. That we need to look at it very careful, the way we have these debates. And the Syria debate showed its real limits, because quite frankly, if you go back, this was the kind of the public confessional on what I did over Iraq. And everybody got up and gave these speeches, which really added very little to a factual debate. What we should do is find a way, and the House can always find its ways. Ideally, I would have liked a session of where I had the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary, and the Secretary of State for Defence on that front bench, and you would have had 5 hours of question and answer sessions. Because quite frankly, the various opinions of various backbenchers may be very entertaining to them themselves, but add very little to the debate. But pinning your three key ministers down as to just what it is they intend to do. So if we are going to go back to greater parliamentary say on this, then I think the way in which we interrogate our front bench has to change. And the third, this is absurd notion out there. The parliament has become so wonderfully strong. No, it hasn't. Parliament is asserting itself in the face of an exceptionally weak executive. If Parliament had become so strong, and if the select committees had become so powerful, we would have been given more staff, we would have more means of actually doing the interrogations, we would have been greater powers to summon witnesses. None of this has happened. All that's happened is that our chairs are elected by the MPs. That gives them greater legitimacy amongst their mates, in a sense, but hasn't really enabled a greater holding to power to the executive. So, where do I think we need to go post, or what can we still do? Now, I'm not foolish enough to think that any of us can contemplate when the next occasion is going to be where we may be called on intervening. You know, I still think it's never going to be the places which you anticipate. What I do think is the most dangerous thing is you have currently a combination of no coherent foreign policy structure as to when you intervene, a foreign office that is essentially the wholly owned subsidiary of UKTI. You've got a Ministry of Defence that regards its, we have now right-sized the army in line with its budgetary requirement. In other words, how much money is in the kitty, and that's how many soldiers we've got. And combined with that, a world that is out there has become so much more dangerous, because what is remarkable about Syria is that unlike previous occasions, this is what isn't state versus state. It is leaders. You know, what does the world community object to is not the Syrians, it's Assad. and the way we actually respond to that. And that leads us into this comfortable notion that more soft power will help. No, you do need soft power, but you need someone to win the war first before you can make the peace. And I finished just with a final observation. Napoleon was right. Tell me what the world was like when you were 20 and I tell you what you think. When I grew up, I always remember one thing of going to an anti-Vietnam demonstration. And my mother, who was a refugee from East, from Czechoslovakia, said to me, she said, I'm so glad you have the luxury to do that because you've never sat in a cellar praying for a week that the Americans get you before the Russians do. This world is a nasty place. And I think rather a kind of self-indulgence. I think we need to become pretty hard-nosed, decide when this country does want to intervene, make sure Parliament can hold it to account, but have a much clearer framework rather than go on wishful thinking as to what the world might be like if only it was perfect.
Ex-soldiers, ex-servicemen, and ex-politicians. So that was quite interesting.